back to the bin.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Back to the Bins. I'm Paul Spataro, and I am joined, I was going to say as always, but not really. I am joined as often as I am by Mr. Scott H. Gardner.
Hello.
Hello. And we are joined by Mr. Sean Whalen.
Gentlemen, thanks for having me today.
And today our plan is to do a score episode to follow up on our recent Supergirl movie review on Is It Yours? And score, now let's, I always have to remember, it's Shameless Obligatory Coattail Riding episode.
Yep, that's it.
Okay, so we have two Supergirl stories to cover today. And the first one I'm going to cover is from 1974. It's Supergirl number 10, and it has guest appearance by Prez. And I remember we were having a talk at one point, you and I, Scott, about like why are certain books on my list? And I think it was, if I remember right, it was to do with I had Karate Kid books on my list.
Right.
And you were just thinking that, you know, that I, like a normal person, and in this case, like you, probably was enamored by some particular artist or writer that was in that series. And that was why I was going for those books. But the reality is, I have this attraction to short-run series. Series that came out in like 5 issues, 4 issues, 7 issues, something like that, and then they went away, especially from the 1970s. Not mini-series, but ones where they gave it a quick shot, and they said, yeah, this ain't working, and then they pulled the plug on it. and I have an affinity towards those, and I look to complete those series. And if I remember right, Karate Kid was either 14 or 15 issues. And I picked it, you know, I think I'm still missing 2 of them. But that's, you know, on a series like that, I want to find them on the cheap. I'm not willing to pay any kind of money for anything.
Right.
You know, it's got to be like $1 or $2 or I'm not buying them. Prez is a similar one in the 1970s. So he appeared in this story, which is a guest appearance. And this story made no bones about it. This is Earth 72. So this is not the Earth that we are used to seeing. And I think it's also called Earth Prez by the DC people. Anyway, it was Supergirl number 10 from October of 1974. And the story is written by Carrie Bates, art by Art Saff, who I'm not familiar with. Inks by Vince Coletta, letters by Ben Oda, and edited by Robert Kaniger and Alan Asherman. The story is titled Death of a Prez. There were 2 stories in this book, but we're only covering the first. Linda Danvers is watching Prez Ricard giving a public speech when she notices a hitman among the crowd. Quickly, Kara changes into Supergirl and foils the assassination attempt. Later, Supergirl saves him from a second assassination attempt and decides to fly him to the White House personally, unknowingly playing right into Master Killer's hands. As watching her from afar, Master Killer gets a witch called Hepzibah to mind control Supergirl as his men fire an emotion manipulator energy weapon. Supergirl gets stuck by both psychic attacks, and although she struggles to break free, she lets Prez drop. Master Killer is congratulating himself until he sees something has melted his radar cranial cannon. Supergirl barges into his lair, having tracked the beam back to its source, and easily stomps Master Killer and his men. Master Killer believes he has won anyway, but later Prez reveals at a press conference that Supergirl flew him to safety to the Fortress of Solitude and dropped a plastic replica to deceive Master Killer's gang. So, really deep story, very intricate and very silly, really. I mean, it's really the bottom line on it. It's but the whole Prez concept was silly. You know, it was they changed the law so that I think an 18-year-old could be president of the United States, and he wins, and he's walking around with the sweater that says Prez on it at all times. I mean, it's really silly. If I remember right, his cabinet is like there's one who's a Native American who dresses like a Native American. And, you know, it, like very much designed to appeal to not so much the counterculture teens, but I think the preteens who want to be counterculture, and giving them a little something to latch hold of.
Who was behind Prez? Was that Joe Simon? I'm trying to remember who was the creative force behind that book. Cause I don't think it was Kirby, right?
No, I don't think so. Let me,
I'm remembering that right. Was it?
I think this is created by Joe Simon and Jerry Grandinetti.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with the second name, but yeah, that's what had stuck in my mind was that it was.
And I think Joe Simon also did Brother Power the Geek. So, I mean, he was.
Oh, yeah, I think you're right.
He was very much into the silly appeal to very young kids stuff by the 1960s and 70s.
Was this Prez's, was this Prez's only guest shot? Because when they did the Prez trade paperback back in 2016, I'm noticing that that this was the only issue of, you know, of the 70s version of him. You know, that's not because so basically what they reprinted the four issues that were published, and then they reprinted Canceled Comics Cavalcade, so an unpublished issue essentially, and then they reprinted this. So does that mean he never had any other guest spots anywhere? Because I think
in that era that you're correct. I think I'm just looking on the DC Wiki page, and there, you know, there was a Vertigo book that came out much later, one and done graphic novel type book. And,
yeah,
we covered that on the show years back with the CGS guys.
Oh, okay.
And I see they have an appearance apparently in the 1989 Swamp Thing series, and then in the Sandman Neil Gaiman series.
Yeah, yeah.
But those would have been all post his initial run. There's right. The three issues of the original series, and as far as I know, in that era, this is the only appearance of the character.
I'm surprised he didn't appear like in Brave and the Bold or DC Comics Presents or something like that, because it seems like just an unusual character where somebody would have done that. But I'm looking through and I'm not seeing any reference to that. Actually, the only Brave and the Bold I saw was him in the cartoon.
Well, Brave and the Bold, I could see him having appeared in. By the time DC Comics Presents came out, he was a memory already.
Yeah, yeah.
I think he came up. I think he was mentioned in our Brave and the Bold episode we did, where we were like, I forget how we titled that, but it was basically like Brave and the Bolds we never got, or that we wished we had gotten, or something to that effect. I think his name came up that we were all surprised that he didn't get a guest shot in Brave and the Bold. I it's weird because I always thought of him as a bigger character, like, you know, like a character that, you know, came along, didn't last very long, and quickly disappeared into obscurity. But while he was out there, he was everywhere in the DCU, and apparently that's not the case at all. He was only ever in Supergirl. But I don't know why that memory persists for me, that I thought that, you know, because he was supposed to be the president, so I thought he appeared in other books, but apparently not. They kept him kind of isolated, I guess.
And that's why I guess they designated it as Earth 72, so that, you know, he wasn't really interacting with anyone else. The one thing about it, says, silly as the story was, apparently she says, unless I missed something, she says she saw with her X-ray vision that this dude was carrying a gun, but she was watching it on TV.
So, right, yes. Yeah, I caught that too, yeah. That shouldn't work that way.
Yeah, I don't think you can X-ray a cathode ray tube to get a...
You said microscopic vision first, though. So this is one time I wish my microscopic vision didn't reveal the real scene I spotted on TV.
But when she stops the guy, she says, Blast, how did you know? And she said, simple, my x-ray vision spotted the gun hidden in your sleeve.
I'm wondering if that was a writing error. Like, because they say microscopic vision at first and then later on say x-ray vision. I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm more saying that they say two different things. The first panel on that page says microscopic vision. Then later on, you're right. She says, simple, my x-ray vision spotted the hidden glove in your sleeve. Was that when they were in person together that she saw that? X-ray vision?
But even from a logistic point of view, and I understand I'm getting too nitpicky here, but even the microscopic vision, I don't know what the DPI was on a TV back then, but I don't think it would be sufficient for you to use your microscopic vision to see that he has a gun in his sleeve.
Earth 72, it was.
they already had the 1080.
Yeah.
On page two, that shot of Prez about to shake somebody's hand. Who is the game show host that guy looks like right there in the ascot? He looks like somebody. There was a game show host that looked like that guy, but I can't place who I'm thinking it would be.
I'm not thinking of a game show host. I'm thinking of the news reporter, Stossel. John Stossel.
I don't know who that is. I love the fashions, though. I don't have a lot on this other than I really do like the cover. I've always liked the cover on this one. This is actually one of the issues that's been in my collection the longest. Now, I'm not saying one of the oldest issues in my collection. I'm saying one of the issues that I've personally owned the longest. I honestly can't remember a time when I didn't own this issue. I have no memory of where and when I acquired it. But I mean, you know, it's from 74, so it had to be, you know, way back, I'm thinking. You know, from childhood until just a very few years ago, this was the only issue of this series I even owned. But it was neat, you know, pulling it out for this. You know, it was kind of like revisiting an old friend, because I did remember this one. I didn't remember the specifics of the story, but more than anything, I remembered the cover. I really liked the Bob Oxner cover on it. I think he draws a really, really good Supergirl. I wish he had done the interior art.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no offense to Saf. I forget what his first name is, but he's okay. I like his art. He's not done any favors here by Vince Coletta, who's doing his, you know, typical hatchet job. I checked out some of Saf's other work to see, you know, him inked by other inkers to see if I would like it any better. It's a little bit of an improvement, but it's not great. I mean, he was mostly doing non-superhero stuff, a lot of romance, a little bit of war, I think, stuff like that. So I don't know that he was necessarily suited to superheroes. I think he probably got this assignment because of his romance comics background type of thing. And that kind of shows, I think. But it wasn't bad artistically. It's just, I really wish Oxner had done the art on the whole issue, because he's a fantastic artist.
Now, the cover is really sharp, but the interior, not so much. The interior is, I was likening it to a Charlton level.
Yeah.
I didn't think it was that good. And then I think I'm mistaken, because I think his name is Art Saf, but they credited it to Art Saf. And then when I looked at the splash page, it says Art:Saf and Coletta. So I was thinking, oh, they misread it. And I thought his name was Art, but I think his name actually is Art.
Yeah.
Because I looked him up and he does have things under that name. So my amusement was purely self-inflicted.
I did like the bit where Prez took the kid's watch or clock and fixed it.
That is supposed to be not a superpower, but that is like one of his skill set, is actually fixing clocks.
Right. And I like that. I like that it went harking back to the miniseries and like kind of introduced that concept with him. I always liked that about Prez. I mean, I thought it was just a charming little bit in a story that, like, and the other part I really enjoyed was Supergirl like overcoming the voodoo, you know, and like recognizing like, hey, somebody's screwing with me, so let me toss him in the fortress and come up with a quick little plan. The story really benefits from the fact that there's two stories in this book, because if this had been a whole issue of this, there would have had to have been a lot of padding. This is an example of a story that is cute and quick and kind of needed to be in order to accomplish its goal. And I think if they tried to do a full issue of this, it would not have worked out.
Well, I'm just looking. His first issue was September of 73. Second issue was November of 73. And the third was January of 74. So now this book is dated October of 74. So this is, in theory, at least 9 months after the Prez series concluded. Oh, no, excuse me. There was a fourth issue. That's March of 74, the fourth issue, which is the final issue of the series.
Yeah.
So from March until October, there were no Prez issues coming out, and yet they still chose to have him as a guest star here. I'm wondering now if this was maybe an extra story stuck in the drawer somewhere, and they pulled it out and said, you know, let's publish it, because I think this is the last issue of Supergirl also.
It is, yeah. Yep. Yeah, I'm trying to remember where she went from here. I don't recall. I'm not sure if her Adventure Comics run was concurrent with this or not. I always had the impression that it was prior to this, but I could be wrong about that. I'm honestly not sure.
No, I'm not sure either, and I don't think I'm going to get a quick answer to that, so I don't want to make everybody sit and wait for me to look that up. I kind of feel like they would have been better served to have a more lengthy story, despite what you guys said, and actually flesh out a little bit of this world and what Prez is and why he's interesting, and have this published while Prez was still coming out in an effort to maybe, you know, build up some interest in that book. However, that is not borne out by the fact that this book was canceled anyway. So it's not like this is the book to ride the coattails of.
Was she really not published again between 74 and 82? I'm just looking it up right now.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
That's a long time to be shelved.
Yeah, she went back to just guest starring. Yeah. Yeah, I was just looking at that very thing myself. Yeah, because I mean, she, you know, she came along and was, you know, a frequent co-star or guest star with Superman in the Superman titles. And then she finally got her own feature in Adventure Comics. I forget what year and what issue number that was, somewhere in the early 400 or late 380s or 90s through like the early 400s. Just prior to, I think the very next feature after her was when the Spectre came in. And that you had Jim Aparo, and I forget who the writer was on that, but anyway, yeah. So she got her own series, but then once the series ended, yeah, she didn't get another series until Daring New Adventures in the '80s. So yeah.
Looks like she went from 69 to 72 in Adventure Comics. So then this series, this Supergirl series, would have been the follow up to that, where they actually gave her a series, you know, titled Supergirl. And it only went 10 issues. And then I think you may be right, Sean. I think Superman Family might have been the next place where she, you know, resided.
Oh, that's right. I forgot. Yeah, that's right. I forgot about
Superman. And that actually went from 74 to 82. So timing-wise, she would have been published in that. I love the Superman Family and Batman Family books.
Yeah, I totally forgot about Superman. That's right. Yeah, Superman Family. I forgot about that. This is still by far my favorite Supergirl outfit.
Yeah, I like the little lace shorts.
Little tassels.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, I know it's a little exploitive, but it is, I just think the most appealing looking of the, uniforms that she's had.
Yeah.
So I like this one, and the head, the one with the headband was a close second for me.
Yeah.
I like that era.
One of these days I'd like to do a series, on her adventure run, but specifically the issues where she decided she needed a different look. And there's a period of time, I'm trying to remember how many issues it is, but it's a decent little stretch where almost every issue she had a completely different costume until she finally settled on this one. And some of the costumes are interesting, some of them are kind of cool, and then some of them are absolutely just god-awful ugly. And I think that would be a fun series to do, is look at just those issues where she changed, just the different costumes that she went through. Because there's some really wild ones in there.
Well, I actually like when they try and do some changes like that. And I think, it goes along with what I was saying about collecting some short run stuff, because like one of the runs that's on my want list that I've completed most of it, I think I only need two more of it, is Wonder Woman jumpsuit issues.
Right.
And it's the same kind of thing where they were trying to just do something a little different with her.
Yeah. 397. There's a cover where she's laying on the cover, looking at all these concept costumes. And if my memory serves, I think they were submitted by readers.
Hmm.
And then starting within an issue or two, by 400, she was then, in 399, she's in a different outfit from, the traditional skirt she'd always worn.
399, then, she's accusing O.J. Simpson of killing his wife.
Yep.
If you look at that cover.
And then almost every other issue, she would be in a new costume. And she bounced around. Then this one here debuted. I forget the exact issue. I was just looking at it the other day. And then there was like one more little spate of another shitty costume. And then she was back in this one. And then this one just stuck after that. So, yeah, that'd be a fun little series to do at some point. Just a fun little examination of the, we could have a little mini series, the shitty costumes of Supergirl. Cause there were some wild ones. I was watching, there's a guy I've been watching on YouTube. I wish I could remember his name to get a Mint Hunter. I think that's it. Mint Hunter. He does a whole series, and a lot of it's like speculation on comics and stuff like that. But he did a series I was watching on just like weird bumps. And there's an issue, one of those issues, it's 409, has a really cool cover of her. She's like assisting a guy that's, I don't know, he's injured or something, laying on the deck of a ship, and creature from the Black Lagoon looking dude is like climbing out of the water and climbing over the railing at her. Apparently this one is now a sought after issue that's gotten a weird bump because it features like a bit of side boob with the weird costume that she was wearing in that issue. So yeah,
she looks kind of like a stripper on the cover.
Yeah. Yeah. No joke.
I'm surprised that got Comics Code Authority approval, honestly. But in the issue itself, she doesn't seem to be wearing the costume that they show on the cover.
Yeah, that happened a couple of times because there's one of them. I forget which one it is. I think it's 398, the issue after the cover with all the new costumes that she's thinking about. 398 shows her back in her skirt again, but I think she's actually wearing one of her new costumes in the actual issue inside. I think she's wearing the same one that she's got on the OJ cover, the very next cover. But I just kind of was flipping through them the other day. But yeah, some of them, the one that really.
Just as a correction on that one issue with the side boob look, there's two stories. And in the second story, she's wearing that costume.
Ah, okay. Which costume is she wearing in the first one?
Kind of the traditional one.
Oh, okay.
Sort of the traditional with the skirt. And then in the story, it's glad I stashed one of my new super outfits in my bag when she puts it on. I mean, it's honestly god awful.
See, this could be fun to play with it because I like video games where they have the unlockable costumes, like alternate costumes for characters. And it's a shame that she's not a bigger character, that you could have a video game that has Supergirl in it. And then as bonus unlockables, you have all these weird alternate costumes that she had over time. Or, you know, if she was still alive and still around in comics, have a story where for whatever contrived reason, she has to go through the back of her closet and reuse these old costumes from, you know, this short little run back in, you know, back in the day. And for whatever reason, dig out some god awful costume from way back when and use it again. I'd love stuff like that. That would be fun.
DC has an MMO, and I'm surprised they don't lean into stuff like that, because that would be, you know, I mean, it'd be an easy source. And you figure people would buy, like, they have these like packets of costumes you can buy or right. for your own create a character. And I'm surprised they don't do more leaning into, you know, any of the characters throughout history, like some of their wackier costumes.
Right.
As just deep cuts. Cause you figure a lot of the players have got to be like hardcore DC fans from various eras. It's a ready-made thing to tap into.
Yeah. That would be fun.
Yeah, I'm looking at a site right now with their complete costume history, and it's funny to see the choices. We'll put that in quotes, the choices that they made.
It's interesting to see, because I'm just looking through the different covers, and you're on the totally on the money with the just, you know, the frequent changes. It's very interesting. Anyway, that shows how much interest we have in the story I chose. So I think we might as well rate it and get on to something with a little bit more meat to it. I agree with Scott. I think this is a very compelling and good cover. And just on the basis of the cover alone, I would like to own this issue, but I don't. I think the cover is a solid B+. It's not an A cover, but it's compelling and it's cool. The interior art is definitely a step down. It reminds me of like I said, it almost has a Charlton kind of feel to it to me. The action doesn't feel like that. When they show them in action, they don't really actually like give you the feeling like they're moving. It's very anti-Gene Colan. I'm going to say C- on the interior art. It's a little below average, but it's not horrible, and you can follow the story. And the story is incredibly silly, not well thought out. But for me, you know, you throw Prez in there, it bumps it up a level just because of the kitschiness of the character. So I'm going to say a C+ on the story. And overall, I'll give the book a C+ based on mostly on the cover.
I really like this cover. I've you know long enjoyed this one, but I'm an easy mark for Bob Oxner. I've always really really liked his stuff. I think he was one of the better Superman cover artists back in the day. So this one really works. Honestly, the only real problem I've got with this cover is I really don't care for the piss yellow background. I think they could have done something, anything. I think. I'm assuming this is supposed to be New York. So isn't that the UN building right behind the Empire State Building right there? So that should be water, right? Where the yellow is, that should be water, right? Have I got my geography right?
Well, the UN building isn't right behind the Empire State Building. Okay. No. You know, the UN building is closer to the water, but the Empire State Building really isn't, you know, that close.
Right.
Although, I mean, from up high like that, maybe you would see the water and maybe it should be a pale blue. Or since it's, I guess, the Hudson River, you know, maybe a murky green.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. Just something different. something also to differentiate it from the yellow in the logo. But honestly, it's a minor quibble. I love the perspective of the shot. It's kind of, you know, that vertiginous thing of, oh, you know, he's way up high and she's going to drop him kind of thing. I really like that. And she just looks fantastic. She looks so sexy on the cover. So I like that a lot. So yeah, on the cover, I think I'm going to go a straight up A. I think I'll go an A on the cover. I like the cover a lot. Interior art, not so much. Really the only thing the interior art's got going for it is, you know, this guy, you know, clearly he, you know, you can tell he's got the romance comics chops, so at least he can draw attractive females. But other than that, yeah, the action's not actiony. The art's very, yeah, I think you called it with the Charlton comparison. It's very Charlton and not good Charlton either. So yeah, not terribly sold on the interior art. I would say I'll go a middle of the road C, because at least the females are attractive, but that's about all it's really got going for it. And then the story, story's kind of dopey, so I'm going to go a C on the story as well. So, I mean, this is, you know, own it for the cover, you know, that's the big thing. I think the cover's, you know, pretty phenomenal on it. So, total grade overall, I will say a B, and I think that's being very generous.
I got this originally at a flea market years ago. That was one of my best scores growing up. We went in Pennsylvania to campground every weekend during the summers, and they always ran a flea market, and there was always somebody with a box of comics, and I mean like a decent sized box of comics. They were in various conditions. Sometimes you'd find a gem, but I mean, it was nothing that you were like finding like this holy grail copy of anything, but they were reader's copies. No other way to say it, but I was a reader, so it was perfect for me. I was always enamored. I got, you know, when I started getting into comics, it was the big ones, you know, Superman, Batman, same thing on Marvel, Spider-Man, Captain America, all that kind of stuff. But I got enamored by the concept of the Superman and Batman family, the extended characters, Supergirl being one of them. I was like, oh, wow, there's a Supergirl concept, and Superboy equally, just being characters that I just love the idea of that history. This one I had, and it was a beat up copy. I mean, like this is I'm looking in the DC app right now at this one. And it's, you know, crisp and clean. And I'm like, oh, so this is what it looked like without it. I think it's a very good cover for, you know, the pieces. I'm not going to regurgitate what you guys said, but I'm very much on the same place. I would give this easily a B cover for me, just because I think Supergirl's great and it's a good cover of Prez. Background, I agree, could use some work. But I usually like the logo. I like the Supergirl logo design. Sometimes there's logo designs that are just kind of eh, and this one stands out at you. I liked this era. So it's got good memories there. The interiors, the artwork is okay. It's good. It's a fun story. I meant what I said earlier, where I liked that this story was more compressed, because I think it was a fun little story that I see your point, Paul. They could have fleshed out this world a little bit, and maybe I'd be having a very different viewpoint on this. It was a fun story that doesn't overstay its welcome for me. So from a storyline perspective, I would say a C+. There's a nostalgic part of me that wants to jump into B-, just because this was a story I got at a flea market as a kid. And I will say, as a kid, when I got it when I was younger, this would have been a B story for me, just because I was a sponge for this. But today it's a C+, because I was like, oh, I remember this. I sort of remember this story and got through it real quickly. The artwork's fine. Just nothing that stands out for me. So I'm a C on the artwork. Overall, on the view, the book, I'm going to go C+ on the book. The only piece that is kind of giving me some extra credit on that is that cover. Cause I do think it's an interesting cover.
Cool. All right. We ready for the next one? All right. Strap in, folks. For our next book, we are going to look at Action Comics number 309. Cover dated on this one is February 1964. On sale date, according to Mike's Amazing World of Comics, was December 26th, the day after Christmas, 1963. Sold for a whopping 12 cents. The cover is irrelevant to the story that we are covering, so we're just going to skip right over that. No creator credits in the issue itself, but from Mike's Amazing World, we learn that the writer on this was Leo Dorfman, and the artist was Jim Mooney, the name I personally most often associate with comic book Supergirl, and we'll talk more about that in a little bit. So to start this one off, I'm just going to kind of recap for you or lay out for you the opening half splash page, the upper half here, and kind of set the mood here. So we're looking at this this rocket, and we've got this couple, and it's almost looks like a recreation of the scene of Jor-El and Lara launching baby Kal-El into space. But this setup's a little bit different. This time we have Zor-El and his wife, Allura, and Zor-El is saying, "Radiation is flooding the city. We're all doomed to die, Kara. Quickly, into this rocket. We're sending you to join your cousin, Kal-El, on Earth, where he has become the mighty Superman." And then Supergirl, the future Supergirl, she's crying, and she says, "How can I desert you now? You can't ask me to do this. I know I'll never see you again." And the copy says, "Here is the great saga for which thousands of readers have clamored." And I'm wondering, is that hyperbole or is that really true? "The tale of Argo City's Day of Doom. In these pages, Supergirl will relive the most tragic events of her life, the destruction of her native city and the loss of her beloved parents. But not even Supergirl is aware of the weird climax of the untold story of Argo City." So one day, Supergirl and her secret identity of Linda Danvers and her guy pal Dick Malvern attend the annual reunion of the Midvale Orphanage, where they reflect on how lucky they were to have been adopted. They hope that the current batch of orphans are someday as fortunate, and they end up giving what I guess was meant to be an inspirational speech to the new kids, but seriously runs the risk of creating false hope, as Linda says, "Someday, all of you will find happiness with foster parents." So she better hope so that that actually happens after telling those poor kids that. Anyway, later as the reunion ends, she runs into a kid named Randy who's got something better than foster parents. He's been reunited with his real parents, thought lost in a flood. Now, while she's happy for Randy, Linda can't help but think back to her own lost parents, Zor-El and Allura, and how they died long ago of kryptonite radiation in her native Argo City. That night, Linda's sleep is troubled as she dreams that her dead parents are calling to her, telling her that they are alive, alive! Linda calls out to them in her sleep and wakes her foster parents, who come in to check on her. She tells them that she was just dreaming. But the next night, the same thing happens. Zor-El and Allura appear to her, pleading that they are alive and near to her, so near. Linda wakes troubled, feeling that her parents are begging her for help, as if they were in some kind of prison. As Supergirl, she goes to Superman's Arctic Fortress of Solitude and utilizes the Zonophone to look into the eerie netherworld of the Phantom Zone, suspecting that maybe her folks are trapped there. But seeing no one but Zod, Jaxxer, and her evil first cousin once removed, Kruel, she decides she is acting foolishly. As she is about to leave the fortress, Comet the Superhorse shows up and with his amazing ESP powers confirms that Supergirl is in fact receiving faint mental voices and is able to project them for her, showing her dead folks pleading that they are alive and in the zone, in the zone, in the zone. Thinking that they mean the Phantom Zone, she snatches up a Phantom Zone projector and races home to her foster parents and convinces the Danvers to project her into the zone, although she does not tell them why. Waiting for her are the three aforementioned Phantom Zoners plus Professor Vacox, whom we did not see before. They follow her, messing with her mind and taunting her that they know where her parents are, but won't assist her. She then comes across Jor-M, another prisoner, and tells him he's not as bad as the others and that if he helps her find her parents, she will put in a good word with Superman and try to get him pardoned. But Jor-M says he does not deserve a pardon and that if not for him, all of Argo City would still be alive. But he does try to help her, although he is thwarted by the combined mental beams of the other other Phantom Zoners who think he's a stool pigeon. Her 10 minutes up, the Danvers bring her out of the zone as prearranged, and she has to admit her mission is not yet complete. She still does not confide in them as to the nature of her mission. She returns to the fortress astride Comet, although she's perfectly capable of flying her damn self, sets about the task of figuring out how her real parents could possibly still be alive when kryptonite radiation killed everyone in Argo City. She utilizes Superman's chronoscope to peer back through time to a period before the destruction of Krypton. There she witnesses the brothers Jor-El and Zor-El, fathers of Superman and Supergirl respectively, discussing the unbreakable plastic dome Zor-El has created to shield and eliminate all germs and diseases within Argo City. Jor-El informs his little brother that his work may have been in vain as he believes Krypton is doomed to die within months. Eventually, of course, Krypton does die, and baby Kal-El is sent to Earth as the planet explodes. However, a large chunk of the planet, the portion under Zor-El's dome, survives the cataclysm and is thrown clear. Argo City is saved. Zor-El is chosen leader and invents basically food replicator technology a la Star Trek The Next Generation to keep everybody alive. Over time, however, the ground turns radioactive due to the nature of the explosion that destroyed Krypton, and lead sheets are laid down to block the deadly rays. Later still, Zor-El marries Allura and baby Kara is born. Zor-El invents a jet drive to guide Argo City through space in hopes of finding some habitable planet to resettle on. Eventually coming within orbit of a yellow sun, the citizens begin to discover they've gained superpowers from its rays. Zor-El informs them that once they've mastered their abilities, they shall all proceed to Earth, adopted home of his nephew Superman, where they'll establish a race of super beings. However, this does not sit well with Jor-M, who believes that this all flies in the face of the gods of Krypton, that they've been angered by the Argonauts having left their native red sun. He goes so far as to use his newfound super abilities to fly outside the dome and redirect the jet drive to carry Argo away from the yellow sun and back towards their native red sun. However, this nearly exhausts the jet drive. Argo then can't return to the yellow sun. For this crime, Jor-M is sentenced to 30 years in the Phantom Zone. Not long after, a meteor shower knocks holes in the protective lead shielding, and again, the people of Argo City are exposed to the deadly radiation. With only weeks to live, Zor-El tests a theory that there exists another zone adjacent to the Phantom Zone, separated by different wavelengths. He and Allura attempt to project themselves into it, but nothing happens. Out of time, out of options, the couple send their daughter Kara to Earth to join her cousin Superman, and thus Supergirl lived whilst Argo City perished. Or so she always believed. Now, for the first time, Supergirl adjusts the chronoscope to see what really befell the city after she was sent away. Indeed, radiation did eventually, slowly, overtake the populace and everyone died. Zor-El and Allura, fighting frantically for the city's survival from disaster headquarters, were the last two people left. As the deadly radiation began to take them as well, suddenly they felt the pull of a delayed reaction to their earlier attempt to access the survival zone, and they were drawn into that shadowy dimension where they still exist, silent and unseen to the real world. Supergirl turns off the chronoscope and promises her trapped parents that she will use all her powers to figure out a way to free them from the survival zone. To be continued. I don't know about you guys. I don't think I had ever read this story before. If I ever did, I didn't remember it. But damn, I liked this. I liked this a lot. I thought this was really good. It's very Silver Age-y, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. I dug it a lot. What did you guys think?
Yeah, I got a kick out of it also. And I think more so having just seen the Supergirl movie, it made me get more of a kick out of it. It is very Silver Age-y, the whole, you know, oh, the one guy just turns the jets around on them. And, you know, I mean, it's silly. And I'm pretty confident that the term stool pigeon probably would not have been used on Krypton.
Right.
So I don't know where these guys would have gotten that unless they, you know, unless they were hanging out in the Phantom Zone watching, you know, film noir movies. But yeah, I got a kick out of it. And it felt like, okay, now I have more of an understanding of the whole thing that we saw in that movie. You know, it was done. They took this story, they eliminated some of the Silver Age-iness of it, but they pretty much hit this story. And I really liked that aspect of it. And I, you know, that was my favorite part of the movie.
Yep.
So then when you give me a comic book background to it, you know, I ate it up.
I loved this one so much that, like, after this recording, I am seeking out and reading issue 310. Cause this story is, I was just looking it up. Like, how does this story wrap up? It's a two-parter and it does wrap up in the next issue. And I want to, the other thing I like too, is we've talked about in the previous issue, the artwork, this one, going back to the Silver Age area, I love the exploration and experimentation with like Superman-y gadgets and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I love me some Silver Age fun.
Yep.
And I feel like with the limitations they had with printing and things like that back in this day, the stuff they did with the Phantom Zone effects in this, I really ate up. I thought it was captivating. It made me believe it existed. It added a horror aspect when the parents are talking about that they've been alone this whole time. And this, thinking the survival zone isn't like this, at least as far as we know, isn't this densely populated zone. It's just the two of them alone together.
Yeah.
That's a scary concept, and not knowing if they could ever, yes, they survived, but is that how you want to survive?
Right. And nobody knows they're there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you want your wife to hear how you're saying it's a horror movie to be stuck alone with your wife?
In a place like this, I think she'd be saying worse. she'd be like, you for this amount of time?
Yeah, but just for marital harmony, yes, of course I'd go to the survival zone with you.
Yes, that's exactly what went, sign me up. I already packed. That would be the key. I'm bringing stuff. Like you mentioned, like we were talking earlier about going to Heroes Con again and maybe not bringing as much stuff and things like that. If I'm going to the survival zone, I'm renting a U-Haul. Like,
right.
like taking everything with me.
Right.
There's no room for me. Well, what could I tell you?
My comics. They gotta go. It's the survival zone. There's nothing else to do.
I need my comics. I need my movies.
I like what you said about wanting to go right on to the next issue, because initially I was thinking about bringing, because this is a backup story within this issue. Mm-hmm. So even though my synopsis was a little long, the story itself is rather short and a pretty quick read. So initially I was thinking this is a continuing story. Why not do both chapters? And then because I liked it so much, I thought, no, let me see if I can do a good job with the synopsis and hopefully entice the listeners to want to go seek it out on their own. So I was glad to hear you say that you likewise like the story so much that you want to go right on to the next chapter to see what happens next, because that's how I felt about it too. So hopefully that'll carry over to the listeners.
I did like the fact that the relationship with the Danvers is expendable. If like, hey, Mom and Dad, can you come down here and help me? I'm not going to tell you why, but I need to go. Superman's not here, and I need to go into the Phantom Zone and do all that. And she's all choked up, basically saying, it's so sad that they're helping me out, but basically, if I find my parents, it's bye-bye. I found that silly. I loved it.
I'm very curious how that all plays out, because, you know, while I consider myself very, very, very well-versed on Superman, especially from this era, I'm not terribly well versed on Supergirl. And so I know, spoilers, I know that Zor-El and Allura are found and that they are rescued and that they do come out and that they're a part of her life, you know, going forward from this. But I know that the Danvers are too. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering what that dynamic was like and how that all plays out. And I'm curious as I get, you know, it's going to be a while, but you know, in the read through that I'm doing of Superman, I'm looking forward to that. That's one of those things I'm looking forward to discovering is what was that like? How did that end up playing out type of thing?
I think any adopted person, which she is an adopted person, seeking out their biological parents would have to tread softly because they're afraid of making those, you know, the people who raised them, who are their adoptive parents, you know, effectively their real mother and father, making them feel like somehow you're minimizing them by seeking out your biological parents.
Right.
So that did feel real to me. You know, when she said, I wish I can confide in them, but I can't bear the thought of hurting them. That right. felt like it was meaningful.
So I am adopted. And I did.
Well, we've adopted you to the Teacher Freaks Network.
You're my two dads. It's like, you know. The difference, though, I was adopted as an infant. I didn't know birth parents. What this rings true to me is she knew the birth parents. So right. there was a relationship there. Granted, this all happened to her when she was young, but she has memories of them. And I loved that aspect of the movie as well. The fact that they brought that into it and that kind of emotion of, why are you sending me away? And those pieces that was in there, I thought that was a great part of the movie. I like it here because these are people she has a connection with, and she has a connection with the Danvers. This is a very, I think, advanced story. I mean, like, and that's something I liked about the Silver Age storytelling. A lot of times Silver Age story gets like criticisms for being like cheesy, and this is a very depth-filled story. It's a depth-filled concept. Yes, it's having Silver Age fun, but that's not taking away from the fact that they're doing some serious, cool character development here that I think is really interesting in this story. And Silver Age a lot of times gets dismissed by people maybe who haven't given it a chance as not having this level of depth. And I really loved how captivated I was by this story. It was genuine. It was my first exposure to it, and I loved Comet. I loved the whole, you know, we got to know a little bit more about her world. There's so much going on in this. Actually, Paul, last story you were talking about how, like, it needed more. There needed to be some more depth and more world building. This is an example of world building right here. Yeah. There's so much going on here that, like, is interesting, and I want to see more of, and I want to know more of it. It's exactly, so I'm going to take back some of what I said earlier with that nice short story is kind of what I wanted. I'm kind of agreeing with you. It would have been nice if it had a little bit more of this development in that story to give me that kind of flavor. Cause this, everything from the main characters, the supporting cast and the villains all have a character dynamic to them in this,
right?
No matter how long or short that they're in it. This is world building 101 right here. I love that.
This story combines a couple of my absolute favorite Superman things, especially Silver Age Superman, that being the Fortress and the Phantom Zone. I love the Phantom Zone. I love that in this, we get the quintessential trio. We get Zod, we get Jaxxer, we get Professor Vacox. We even get Cruel in there, which is cool because he kind of came and went. He wasn't used a whole lot, but it was neat seeing those guys. But for me, especially Jaxxer, he's my favorite. He's the first Phantom Zoner, so I have a real affinity for him. But there was a great, great surprise in this that I was totally unprepared for. Jor-El. When Jor-El showed up, I'm like, oh my God, I know who this guy is. I know who this guy is. It got me so excited. So if anybody from Mike's Amazing World, I don't know who's maintaining that site, but I know some human being is maintaining Mike's Amazing World. So if anybody from that site, involved in that site, or knows the people that are involved in that site, is listening to this, please let them know there's an error on the page for this story. it incorrectly states that there are no further or no future rather appearances for Jor-El. And for that matter, it fails to note that this is Jor-El's first appearance. Typically, Mike's Amazing World would note first appearances. With this, there is no first appearance note. But the what really stuck out to me was when it says no future appearances after his name. Jor-El did appear again, and in fact, he's one of the major participants in the excellent Phantom Zone miniseries in 1982. He's a pivotal character, and he even fought Batman. So I really gained a new level of appreciation for Steve Gerber, who wrote that series, in really knowing or really researching his Phantom Zone lore to pull out such an obscure one-time use character like Jor-El for that series. And Jor-El's not the only one he did it with. He did the same thing with Quexel, who is the central character of that series. We'd only ever seen him one other time too. So I thought that was really cool. But yeah, so when Jor-El, when she's wandering through the zone and runs into Jor-El, I'm like, I got excited. I'm like, oh my God, I know who this guy is. That was really cool.
You mentioned lore, and one of the things that stuck out to me is I'm a fan in comics of, I love history, like, and I love the history of characters and them being developed, but I love it when it doesn't feel like I'm reading a history book. It feels like I'm living it.
Right.
And he did a great job in this of not beating you over the head with it, organically feeding it to you, where I want to see more next issue. Like, I want more. They made me hungry for more of this than anything else. And you're right. As far as like that Phantom Zone miniseries, I actually haven't read that. This is making me want to jump after this to read the second part of this and then read that miniseries.
You've never read Phantom Zone?
No. And it's, I'm surprised I haven't, because it's right up my alley. So as you were saying that, I'm like, it's Steve Gerber. I'm like, oh, how did I miss that?
Phantom Zone is right under Crisis on Infinite Earths for me as my all-time favorite comic thing ever, because Phantom Zone just it's awesome. It is such a good, I highly encourage you to seek it out, and you can still find that entire series in the dollar bins. But it's fantastic. Great art by Gene Colan and Tony DiZuniga. It's written by Steve Gerber of all people, but man, he either really knew his stuff, or he just researched the hell out of it. But one way or the other, it's an excellent read. And yeah, he dug deep for characters on that, but it's cool. And it's a nice little
EC app. I'm like, look.
There you go.
I just did a search and it's on there. I want to read the actual physical issues, but I just looked on there, and the issues of the miniseries are on the DC app. So you can, if you have that, you can read it right now.
It's good stuff, because although I'm not aware of Colan doing much, if any, Superman prior to that, it feels like a little slice of DC at that time, because two of the big guest stars in the book were Batman and Wonder Woman, both of whom Colan had either just worked on, was working on, or would work on like right after. So, you know, it feels very organic. His art kind of pulls the whole thing together, because he already had such a toehold in DC that was happening at that time. So it's a good series. That's pretty much all I've got. I did make note of this story has been reprinted. It was reprinted in Adventure Comics 416 in 1972, which I think was one of the big thick, I don't know if it was 80 pages, but it was one of those big thick reprint books. Showcase presents Supergirl Volume 2 trade paperback in 2009, and then Supergirl the Silver Age Omnibus Volume 2 hardcover in 2018. So it's out there, and it's good stuff. Did you guys have anything else on this? No? All right, we'll do grades. I am not going to grade the cover. Oh, I did have one other thing, by the way. I was just going to mention the cover. I'm skipping over the cover, but this is the famous JFK issue. I purchased this. I just happen to have notes on it. I bought this from Mercari for $6.90 back in March 18th, 2025. So a little over a year ago. I think it must have been part of a batch. It must have been part of a lot. But anyway, $6.90 is a real steal for this issue because this is the famous JFK stands-in for Clark Kent issue that was published in December of 63 after JFK had been assassinated. So typically this book is a bitch to find it at a really good price. So I really lucked into getting it for that price. But anyway, the cover is not relevant to the story that we're covering here. So I'm not factoring that one into my grade, although it is a pretty cool cover, especially when you know who Clark is on the cover. Interior art. This is where I want to talk a little bit about Jim Mooney. I freaking love Jim Mooney, and I can understand why other people might not have, you know, the same feelings for him, whatever. He is, at the end of the day, probably the textbook definition of workmanlike. His story, his stuff is not particularly exciting or dynamic or whatever, but I can't help but love it because when I was first getting into comics, you know, getting serious about being a comics guy in the early 80s, Mooney was working on Spider-Man. I'm trying to remember which title. I think it was Spectacular, I think. And I remember he did some issues written by Roger Stern, like the one where the Gibbon came back. I never realized the Gibbon was supposed to be a mort. I thought the Gibbon was cool, and I loved the way Jim Mooney drew him. And I really have a very fond soft spot for that era of Spider-Man because I really liked the stories and I really liked Mooney's art. So I'm very forgiving of his art, even though it's, you know, it's probably not the prettiest or the most dynamic thing out there. And whenever I think of Supergirl, you know, comic book Supergirl, I always think of Jim Mooney because as a kid, you know, picking up back issues or being given, you know, coverless comics by my relatives that worked in paper mills, you know, basically saving them from the pulper. If there was a Supergirl backup story in those books, damn if it wasn't drawn by Jim Mooney. He was just always the guy. He was always the guy with Supergirl stories that I, you know, that fell into my lap as a kid. So I just, you know, they're indelibly linked in my mind. And so I really dug the art in this. To me, it worked perfectly because I just, this is what I think of when I think of Supergirl. So, you know, if you guys don't agree, I can totally get that because a lot of it is sentimentality talking, but I really enjoyed the art in this. So for me personally, I'm going to say on the art, I think I'm going to give it a solid B. I think it's perfectly serviceable, which is not necessarily a bad thing to say about something. I don't mean that as a, you know, as a derogatory statement. I think it works for what it's meant to do. Could it be a little more jazzy or a little more? Oh, sure, it could. But for what it is, I think it works pretty darn good. And the story is a straight up A+. I mean, I'm impressed by the level of sophistication for what this is. It's a backup story in the Silver Age featuring Supergirl and a flying horse. It should be really stupid. Most of them, honestly, are pretty stupid. But this particular story, I thought, really had some depth, really had some character. And I really dug it. So overall grade on this, I'm going to stay a straight up A. I thought it was really solid. I'll shut up now.
All right. I'm going to jump in now and I'm going to say, I don't consider the cover part of this. And in my mind, I've created the splash page or the half splash, whatever you want to call it, as the cover on this story.
Right.
And I like that very much. So I'm going to jump right to the art, which is what you were talking about. And I think I tend to agree with you on this. I don't think Mooney was well suited for the Bronze Age, but I think his artwork really is very clean and fits the era that it came out in here and the type of story that we're getting here. I think there's certain shots of Supergirl where she looks really sharp. I think, you know, the artwork is absolutely good here. I'm not going to say it's acceptable or that it's okay. I think it's beyond that. It's good. So I'm going to go with you, and I'm going to give the artwork a B. I think it's I enjoyed reading this, and part of the reason was the artwork. The story, I think I'm higher on it having seen the Supergirl movie than I would be if I hadn't. But having seen the movie, having enjoyed that sequence so much, and then seeing, you know, reading the historical background to what went on in that movie, I really liked it, even despite some very Silver Age-y touches to it. I'm not going to say a straight up A because there are those Silver Age-y touches. So I'm going to say a B plus on the story. And overall, I'll give this book a B plus, or this story a B plus.
As a kid, the library near me had the Flash Gordon strips in like hardcover collections and some of the Buck Rogers. And when I look at this artwork, and it harkens back to stuff like that. I liked pulpy adventure stuff and things like that. And some of the Silver Age-y stuff kind of gets into that for me. I mentioned world building before, and so much of that is driven by the art. There's a lot going on in these panels, which I really appreciate. They get a lot of panels in the story, and it moves along really well. So it's a B plus for me on the art, just because of just how much I enjoyed the visual experience of this. The story in and of itself, I was gushing over the fact that I want to read more of this. I want to read the Phantom Zone miniseries you mentioned before. And that's because of this story. This story really excited me. And I'm really excited to read part two of this. It's an A-plus story for me because of the fact that it's pulling me in to do more instead of just like being done here and kind of walking away and going, well, that was fun. Which the previous story kind of left me in the, that was fun. No, this one, I really want to read not only more the next issue, I'm probably going to wind up reading more of these Supergirl stories along the way, just because of, I'm kind of jonesing for more of this now. And I love the fun factor of this. Paul's right on the, some of the Silver Age-y stuff in there. I kind of expect that with Silver Age-y. But I think that the mileage of that, I think, varies from person to person, and I completely understand it. But for this, this story is an A for me. I mean, this whole, you know, when I put the whole package together, it's an A. I like Paul's point about that splash page being the cover. And I do think that that would be a, if this was just a Supergirl book, that would be a great cover for this story. I wasn't thinking of that at first until he said it. But for me, that's where I'm at too, because this would be an absolutely perfect cover. And I, another logo that I love.
All right. So that's it for our Supergirl score episode. I hope the listeners enjoyed it. I want to thank Sean for joining Scott and I in, on our Supergirl adventure.
Thank you.
And thank you, everybody, for listening. And we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiManzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.